Hello, and welcome to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Monger. He's the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. At Light the Way, we believe the most powerful tool we possess when sharing our faith with others is the Word of God. It was the Apostle Paul that said, "Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of Christ." So as we open the Word together, it's our prayer that you'll not only receive what God has for you, but share what you learn with those you come in contact with. And now, here's Pastor Colin.
If we could turn in our Bibles to the book of John chapter 4. We are in a series that we've called Get Off the X. And it's kind of a shock title because it tells us that this is probably an urgent thing. Get off the X. And you can't say that forcefully enough. Because the X is the kill zone. The X is the spot you don't want to be. The X is where the enemy wants you so he can attack you and so he can do all kinds of things against you. The X is where you're going to be worn down. The X are the spiritual traps that we face, the temptations, the battles we fight. And so we need to recognize that we're on the X, and then we need to get off the X. And so that's what the series has been all about. And this morning, we've got a message called Get Off the X of Regret. And it is in John chapter 4. Sarah was one of the richest women in all of Connecticut. All the colleges wanted her money. All the politicians wanted her support. And all the social events wanted her attendance. By all accounts, Sarah had a perfect life. She was rich, she was powerful, she was popular, but she was also miserable. At just 5 weeks old, Sarah's daughter had died. Later that year, her husband also passed away. She lived alone with all of her money and all of her memories and all of her fame and all of her regret. And so Sarah decided that she needed a new life, and she would move from Connecticut to California and start over, and so she did. And she took all of her money, and she bought this home out there with land, and she hired a full army of carpenters to come and work on this house, and they started expanding it into a mansion. The only thing is, Sarah had some peculiar demands of her construction workers. For example, she told the carpenters that she wanted stairs built that went to nothing at all. She wanted doors that would open to a brick wall. There was one door in particular that opened to a 50-foot drop in the floor, and so don't go through that one. You're not coming back. There were secret hallways, hidden rooms, tunnels, trap doors, passages, all kinds of things. Throughout the home, Sarah insisted that the number 13 would be represented just about everywhere. And so there were 13 hooks in the closets, for example. There were 13 panels on all the doors, 13 lights on the chandeliers, 13 panes in the windows. When it was all said and done, the house featured 6 different kitchens, 13 bathrooms, 40 staircases, 47 fireplaces, not to mention 52 different skylights. 467 doors, 167 rooms, and over 10,000 different windows. Sarah had her home. You see, Sarah was haunted, she believed, by ghosts. And so she built a house that was so confusing, her hope was that they'd be lost and wouldn't be able to get to her. Only these were no ordinary ghosts. She believed that she was haunted by the ghosts of dead soldiers and Indians and frontiersmen and pioneers and cowboys because Sarah's last name was Winchester, and her family had developed the Winchester repeating rifle, which at the time had become the most deadly weapon in the world, and hundreds of thousands of people died because of it. And so Sarah lived with all of that regret, and she lived as a prisoner in what is now known as the Winchester House. It's in San Jose, California. You can go, and you can actually tour it if you want. But Sarah lived that way, in a prison of her own home, a prison of her own making, a prison of her own regret. And the truth is, everywhere we go, we will find people who are living in a prison of regret. Only it might not be a mansion filled with rooms and stairs and doors and tunnels and passageways and all of that, but rather a prison of a mind filled with bad memories. a prison of a heart filled with guilt about past mistakes and decisions, walls of thoughts like, that one time when I was younger, I can't believe I did that. Thoughts that remind us of the past, things that we wish we wouldn't have done. And that is those prisons that are haunted with voices that say things like, you're not good enough, that no one likes me, nobody wants me, no one wants to be around me. And I imagine that there are people who are listening to this right now and they're living in a prison of yesterday's guilt. Things they just can't get past and they can't move on from. And look, it's not always obvious who that might be. This morning, we're going to read about a woman like Sarah, like many other people, who is trapped in a prison of her past life. And it tells us here in John 4, verse 7, that a woman of Samaria came to draw water. It says in verse 8, for the disciples of Jesus had gone away into the city to buy food. And so just imagine the scene. Jesus arrives at this well in Samaria. We're going to talk about it here in just a minute. He sends his disciples as a group to go into the town at the very same time this woman is coming out. And so they pass each other on the trail. Certainly they did. And to them, she's just another person walking, doing something. And to her, this is just another group of guys. They couldn't tell that anything was bothering her or that she was suffering from anything. And no doubt as she passes them, she drops her head and averts her stare, anything to avoid a conversation. She doesn't want to look into their eyes because she's certain they're going to be judging her for all the things that she judges herself for. And it just reminds us that we can't always tell who's suffering, that lots of people do suffer quietly because they're embarrassed, because they're worried what others might say, because they're convinced that it'll ruin any relationships and friendships that they have. But nonetheless, that is this woman this morning. She's a woman who's living in a prison of her past mistakes. The Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 7 that godly grief leads to repentance, but worldly grief leads to death. And that is the difference between remorse and repentance, which leads us to a better way of living, versus regret, which traps us in bondage to the past. And so this morning, I want to talk about getting off the axe of regret. And I want to look at a woman who does that very thing and see what it is that happens to her and how she's able to escape this prison of her own mind. And so it begins in John chapter 4, where it says in verse 1, therefore, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself did not baptize, but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee, but he needed to go through Samaria. So he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, give me a drink. For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And so right away, we're introduced to the famous Samaritan woman by the well. And right away, we see that she's suspicious of Jesus Christ. And that's because if you lived during her time, you'd be suspicious too. You see, Samaritans and Jews were not friends. The Jews didn't like the Samaritans at all. In fact, they looked at them as a kind of half-breed race of people. And it dates all the way back to when Babylon had invaded and occupied the area, that Babylonian men would come in and they would marry Jewish women and they would move them out of Judea and into the land formerly known as Samaria. And in those marriages, they would produce children which were half Babylonian and half Jewish. And so they became known as the Samaritan race because they lived in the area that was formerly known as Samaria. But the Jews couldn't stand it. To the Jews, these were unclean people. They were half-breeds. They were pagans. They were idolaters. They were an abomination to the Jewish race. The Old Testament was clear. God said, don't intermarry with outside nations. And yet it seems that the women had done that. And so the Jews of Jesus' day could not stand the Samaritans. So much so that if a Jewish person had to go through the land of Samaria, they wouldn't. Judea was south of Samaria, which was south of Galilee. To the east was a mountain range, and to the other side was essentially the sea. And so what would happen is if a Jew had to go from Judea to Galilee, as Jesus is doing here, they would first travel around the mountain range, which would add days to the journey, but anything to avoid stepping foot into the unclean place of Samaria. And so it's interesting that it tells us here in verse 4 that Jesus needed to go through Samaria. Because Jews didn't do that, and Jesus has made this journey before, and he didn't do that, but this time is different. It's also why this woman is so suspicious, and why she's so surprised at Jesus, who's a Jew, when he speaks to her, because again, that didn't happen. And that's why she says here in verse 9, "What is it that you, a Jew, ask for me a drink, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." And so it tells us that she's a Samaritan woman. But then something else comes up later in verse 18. "For you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly." So we find out not only is she a Samaritan woman, but she's been married five times. And now she's living with a man that she's not married to. So we get a picture of this woman and who she is and why she might be at the well at 12 p.m. And we know that because it tells us in verse 6, it was the sixth hour. They started 0 hour was 6 a.m. our time. By the time you got to noon, it was the sixth hour. And so this is not exactly the ideal time to be doing some kind of outdoor chore, especially not in the Middle East. Typically, women drew water early in the morning before the sun became too high and the temperature was too hot. They went in groups for safety because one woman by herself against a thief or against a group of thieves or robbers or kidnappers didn't stand a chance. And so they went in groups. They went early in the morning, but not this woman. She goes at the hottest part of the day and she goes by herself. And no doubt that's deliberate. No doubt she's avoiding all the others. No doubt she's living in the regret of all of her decisions, and she's tired of all the gossip, and she's tired of all the name-calling, and she's tired of the comments and the looks and the sneers and the sideways glances and the gossip and the giggles. She's tired of walking into a group of people and all of a sudden the conversation stops. She's tired of that. And because it tells us in verse 18 that she has had five husbands, it doesn't say that she's a widow. It's reasonable to infer that all of these marriages fell apart for some reason. And so this woman is the talk of the town. She is the example of what not to do. And no doubt mothers are using her as an example to scare their daughters. Oh, don't do that. You don't want to end up like her, do you? Look at her all by herself. She gets her water during the hottest part of the day. Nobody wants to talk to her. No one wants to be around her. If you do what you're doing now, you're going to end up just like that woman around the corner. And so no doubt she's tired of that. And to add insult to injury, it tells us that the man that she's currently with doesn't want to marry her either. And so to him, she's good enough to keep around. She's good enough for chores. She's good enough for companionship. She's good enough for the night routine, but she's not good enough to take as a wife. And so every day, this woman gets up. And maybe for a moment, as she opens her eyes early in the morning and she rubs the sleep out of them, she forgets for just a moment who she is and where she is. But then she looks around the room and she remembers this is her life. And every day she waits for the others to clear out before she goes and gets her water. Every day she watches all the happy couples in town and she watches from a distance as they walk to church together. As they play and laugh and she can overhear through the windows as the family's around the dinner table. She watches dad throw the ball in the front yard and the dog chase the bone. And no doubt she says, "That's what I wanted. All I wanted was a family. All I wanted was a little bit of joy and children." And every day she's reminded that that's not her. And she says, "I'm not worthy of that." Her choices made sure of that long ago. And at some level, she probably wonders what many people would wonder in her condition, and that is, what's wrong with me? Why do these things keep happening to me? And look, nobody goes to the altar thinking that the marriage is going to fail. I've done a lot of weddings as a pastor. I'll tell you, I've never counseled a couple about to get married. And they go, yeah, we've kind of figured we're going to get divorced in a couple years. It's just not what happens. They don't stand up here and look in each other's eyes and say all the vows and do all the things, thinking that in just a few years, they're going to hate each other and separate and hire lawyers and a judge is going to get involved and all their stuff's going to get divided. Nobody thinks that. And certainly she didn't think that. But then that's what happened. It failed. And then it failed again and again and again and again. And at some point, she resigned herself to this life. And every day, she makes the same trip. At the same time, she goes to the same well. Her face is weathered by the sun. Her clothing is old and torn and tattered because there's no one to care for her. She's a woman who's just going through the motions of the day. She's not dying, but she's not living either. She's just existing. And so it says in verse 7, a woman of Samaria came to draw water. And how many of us can resonate with this Samaritan woman? How many of us have made mistakes? And so we assume, well, because of that, that's it. It's all done now. And there's no hope, point of hoping for more. There's no hope in the future. That because I have a past, there's no point in thinking it's ever going to get any better. I'm damaged merchandise. Nobody's ever going to want me. And there's no reason I should expect that they would. And maybe for you, there's something that you just can't forgive. Maybe it's something that you think, if they knew, then they'd never talk to me again. If they just knew that about me, they wouldn't want to be in the same room as me. And so we go through the motions of the day, just hoping it doesn't come up. Hoping that we just don't get noticed. Hoping that we can keep our head down long enough and avoid the crowd. And maybe we change the topic when something gets too close to home, because they will never understand. And it's just easier than having to explain it and go through it and see all the looks. And so we wait until the coast is clear. We wait until it's safe. We wait until everyone else is gone. Anything to avoid the discomfort and the awkwardness, just like a woman of Samaria who came to draw water. And so she goes to this well, just like every other day. Only this isn't going to be like every other day. Today, she has a divine appointment with Jesus Christ, and she doesn't know anything about it. You see, before this woman even got out of bed, Jesus was walking her direction. It says in verse 3 that he left Judea, departed again to Galilee, but needed to go through Samaria. It tells us later that it was about the sixth hour. And so we know that they started their journeys around daybreak, around 6 a.m. And so by the time we get to this point, Jesus has been walking for 6 hours. It was about a 6-hour walk from where he was to this town of Sychar. And so for 6 hours, he's been on the road through the dust and the heat. For 6 hours, there's no time to waste because he's got to meet her today. Not tomorrow, that's too late. He knows something no one else knows. Today is the day that she's going to have her life changed. And so you just think about that for a minute. She gets up, she gets out of bed, she gets dressed and has breakfast and mills around the house a little bit. She starts her chores, she feeds the animals, she works on the laundry, and then she gathers the jar. And no doubt as she does that, she pauses and just kind of stares into the emptiness of it. And it resonates in her soul how empty this thing really is. And she thinks about her life and everything starts flashing back again. And then she looks out of the window. She can see the well from her house and she can see, okay, they're finally gone. No one's there. I can go out and I can get my day started. All the while thinking it's just another day. Could have been Thursday for all we know. It was nothing special about this day. But what she doesn't know is that before she even steps foot outside of her door, Jesus is waiting for her. that before she even lays eyes on him, that she was on his heart and in his thoughts. That before she even starts her journey to this well, he's been walking for 6 hours to meet her. You see, for her, this is just a chance encounter, but Jesus has been making his way the whole time. And I love that about God, how even before we see his presence, that he's moving in ways that we can't see and we don't realize. It reminds me of the story in Daniel, where Daniel had prayed for an answer to something. And finally, an angel shows up. Now, to Daniel, the angel just showed up. Oh, there he is. And the angel says, "You don't know the half of it, Daniel. I would have been here 21 days ago, because as soon as you prayed, I was dispatched to give you an answer. But I was fought by the prince of Persia, and so I've been on my way to you for the last 3 weeks." The Bible says in Romans 8 that God works all things together for the good. In John 5, Jesus said, "My Father is always at work." And so understand, by the time you see God do something, he's already been working on the problem, which means he is already working on the marriage. He's already working on the illness. He's already working on the provision. He's already working on the addiction and the job search and the prodigal that you're praying for. He's already working on the anxiety and the stress and depression and loneliness and fear and anything else we can think of that we're praying, "Lord, please help me with that." And we don't see anything changing. It's just day to day, the same thing. It's just Thursday to us. But God has been hard at work the whole time. In Isaiah 43, it says, "Behold, I am doing a new thing." In Habakkuk, it says, "If I told you what it was, you wouldn't even believe me." And so the whole time we're going through the motions of life, God is on the move in life. And so it says here in verse 3 that Jesus left Judea. He departed for Galilee. He's headed north, but this time is different. This time he needs to go through Samaria. It tells us in verse 5, "So he came to Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son." In verse 6, it says that he came to a well. He was wearied from his journey, and he sat by the well. And it tells us in verse 7 that a woman of Samaria came to draw water. And so here we see this woman. And she has no idea this man. She doesn't know who he is. She's never seen him before. All she can see is he's sitting on her well. He's ruining her daily routine. He's going to upset everything that she understands to be true. All she wants is to be left alone in peace to do her chores without being harassed. And now here's this guy, and she might have to talk to him. And then to her horror, he starts talking to her first. But I love how he begins. He doesn't start with a lecture. He knows all about this woman. He doesn't start with her sin. He doesn't start with introducing himself. He doesn't even offer prayer. He simply makes a request, "Can I have a drink?" And look, one of the best things you can do for a person who feels worthless is to remind them that they're not. That they still have something to offer, even if they don't realize it, even if they don't see the value in it. The fact is, whatever it is, however small it might be, there's something they can do to help someone else, something they can give of themselves to bless someone else, even if it's just a cup of water. And you can tell she's not ready for any of this. Because in verse 9, then the woman of Samaria said to Jesus, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." And just like with Nicodemus in John 3, Jesus knows what's really on her mind. And so notice him in verse 10, he answers and says, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where are you going to get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock?" Jesus answered and said to her, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of living water springing up into everlasting life. And certainly, we know what Jesus is talking about. It's interesting that she sees this in a literal sense, and it's true in a literal sense. Drink the water, you'll get thirsty again. But it is more important in the spiritual sense, in the figurative sense. Jesus knows why this woman keeps coming to this well. There's lots of wells in the area, other wells in Sychar. There's other ways to get your daily water, but for some reason, she keeps coming to this one. Even though all the other women are there, even though she's got to make sure the coast is clear, for some reason, she comes here. And it seems that this well is special to her because she says in verse 12, our father Jacob gave us this well. And so maybe she comes there because it's nostalgic. Maybe it reminds her that she is part of a family. And even though life is rotten for her, for just a few minutes, she can remember where she comes from. Maybe she comes to pray because later in verse 20, she says, our fathers worshiped on this mountain. So maybe for her it's that. It's a time that she can connect with God in the only way that she knows how. Not realizing just how far away she really is from him, but doing anything for some peace. Maybe she's just kind of going there to imagine a whole different way of living. But whatever the reason is, she keeps coming back to this well. This is the well of her habit. This is the well of her daily routine. This is the well of her past. This is the well that reminds her of everything that's wrong with her life. And just like the stones keep the water inside of it, they also keep her mind and her spirit and her hopes and her joy. In Ecclesiastes, it says in chapter 5 that the riches are kept by their owner to their hurt. And that is this woman. She keeps coming back to the well that's causing the hurt. At first, she went to the well of men. She got married and then remarried and then married again and again and again. 5 times she was married. Now she's living with somebody, but for some reason that's not working. They've all left one by one. Now the last guy in line doesn't even want to marry her. And so for whatever reason, she keeps going to the well of acceptance from men, but that didn't work. And so now she's coming to the well of ritual. She's coming to the well of the past. She's coming to the well of predictability. There's just something comforting about this for her. And look, there is comfort in going through the same motions every day. There's something safe about it. I love waking up in the morning and knowing where my coffee cup is. And I'll tell you, if my wife ever moved it to like another shelf, I'd be lost. Honey, where's the coffee cup? I like knowing where it is. I like knowing where my socks are. They're in a particular drawer. It's a magical drawer, by the way. I got to tell you where we got this dresser. I don't know. It was like from Narnia or something. But every time the socks run out, poof, they reappear. It's just great. You wear socks, you throw them in like this blue basket, and in a couple of days, all the magic happens, and there they are again. It's like a magical drawer. I love it. But you move my socks to, you know, I don't know, my pants drawer or something, I'm not going to be able to get dressed very well. And so I just love the routine. I love knowing that I can turn my truck on at a certain time, and by the time I get to it, it'll be warm. And I love knowing the route that I get to come here. And when they shut down that bridge over there near Giant, I'll tell you, my life was just, I had to find a new route. I had to plan a new routine in the morning. There's just something comfortable about going through the motions. And yet, ironically for her, it is that very thing that's keeping her in a prison of regret. And so Jesus says, you're not going to find any peace in that at all. Notice he says in verse 13, Jesus answered and said to her, whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. And look, the same is true for us. There is no peace. There is no fulfillment. There is no meaning in life at the well of regret. At the place that constantly reminds us of all the mistakes we ever made, all the failures we ever had, all the times that we fell short. And yet we keep going back and we say things like, well, you know, if I just would have done it differently. You know, I think about that all the time and I wonder what life would have been like if I had made a different choice. If I'd taken a different job, if I'd married a different person, if I had gone to a different college or gone to college or not gone to college. What if I would have invested my money differently? Or what if I would have gone to that doctor's appointment the day that I missed it? What if I wasn't so hard on the kids? What if I had been harder on the kids? What if I listened to my parents? What if I would have done this or that? And we go down the road of what if things would be different. And in counseling, it's called bargaining. And basically, it means we start going through this motion, this exercise in our mind that says, if I had done it differently, then I would have had a better result. And I will tell you, there is no peace in that exercise at all. It's chasing a mirage in the desert. It looks appealing, but there is no peace in the land of woe's me. There is no peace on the what-if journey, and it is an easy place to get trapped. And look, it is tempting. It is tempting to have the pity party and to start thinking, well, you know, I guess this is as good as it's ever going to get. And it's tempting because as long as we have our mind there, we don't have to actually try anything because there's no point, because it won't work, so why bother? And so we just go through the motions of life. And we become like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Remember him? I guess my house will probably fall down anyway. Lost my tail again. And there are so many people living like Eeyore. They just keep going back to that well of regret. You know, the Bible says in Philippians 3, forgetting what lies behind and straining toward what lies ahead. In Ecclesiastes 7, it says, say not that the former days were better than these. That's not from wisdom. You can put it in modern language. He says, that's not very smart. And the point is, there is no peace in constantly resurrecting and returning to the past. And so Jesus tells her that. He says, look, whoever drinks of this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water I will give will never thirst. And you know she's skeptical about this whole idea because in verse 11 she says, who are you? You think you're better than Jacob? I mean, he dug this well. If there could be better water than this, certainly Jacob would have found it. Jacob was God's guy. Jacob is the patriarch. Jacob gave us this water. He used it. It was good enough for him, good enough for his sons. And so where do you get this better stuff? And then they have this kind of back and forth between the two of them. By the way, this is the longest conversation Jesus has with any single person in all of the Bible. And it's reserved for a woman no one wants in a place the Jews won't go. And so they have this conversation, and then finally, you get to verse 25, and the woman tries to shut it all down. She goes, okay, look, I know the Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he'll tell us all things. He'll set the record straight. And Jesus says to her, I who speak to you am he.
You've been listening to Light the Way with Dr. Colin Munger, the senior pastor of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. If you'd like to hear this message again, stop by our website at lightthewayradio.org. Not only will you find an archive of Pastor Colin's teachings there to listen to, but there you can find out more about our ministry. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world," and we want everything we do and say to revolve around that. If you'd like to get behind what we're doing, please visit lightthewayradio.org. Thank you for listening today, and come back next week as Dr. Colin Munger once again delivers another helpful message from God's Word to help us light the way. In the meantime, remember to be a light to someone this week.